Chapter 3. Hort Town. In the darkness before dawn, Aaron dressed in clothing that had been given him, seaman's garb, well-worn but clean, and hurried down through the silent halls of the great house to the eastern door, carven of horn and dragon's tooth. There the doorkeeper let him out and pointed the way that he should take, smiling a little. He followed the topmost street of the town, and then a path that led down to the boathouses of the school, south along the bay shore from the docks of Thwill. He could just make out his way. Trees, roofs, hills, bulked as dim masses within dimness. The dark air was utterly still and very cold. Everything held still, held itself within, withdrawn and obscure. Only over the dark sea eastward was there one faint clear line, the horizon tipping momently towards the unseen sun. He came to the boathouse steps. No one was there. Nothing moved. In his bulky sailor's coat and wool cap he was warm enough, but he shivered, standing on the stone steps in the darkness, waiting. The boathouses loomed black above the black water, and suddenly from them there came a dull, hollow sound, a booming knock, repeated three times. Adam's hair stirred on his scalp. A long shadow glided out onto the water, silently. It was a boat, and it slid softly towards the pier. Aaron ran down the steps and onto the pier, and leapt down into the little boat. "Take the tiller," said the Archmage, a lithe, shadowy figure in the prow, "and hold her steady while I get the sail up." They were out on the water already, the sail opening like a white wing from the mast, catching the growing light. "A west wind to save us rowing out of the bay. That's a parting gift from the master wind key, I don't doubt. Watch her, lad. She steers very light. So then, a west wind and a clear dawn for the balance day of spring. Is this boat look far?" Aaron had heard of the Archmage's boat in songs and tales. "Aye," said the other, busy with ropes. The boat bucked and veered as the wind freshened. Aaron set his teeth and tried to keep her steady. "She steers very light, but somewhat willful, lord." The Archmage laughed. "Let her have her will. She is wise also. Listen, Aaron." And he paused, kneeling on the thwart to face Aaron. "I am no lord now, nor you a prince. I am a trader called Hawk, and you're my nephew, learning the seas with me, called Aaron, for we sail from Enlad. From what town? A large one, lest we meet a townsman. Temir, on the south coast? They trade to all the reaches." The Archmage nodded. "But," said Aaron cautiously, You don't quite have the accent of Enlad." "I know. I have a Gauntish accent," his companion said, and laughed, looking up at the brightening east. "But I think I can borrow what I need from you. So, we come from Temir in our boat Dolphin, and I am neither lord nor mage nor Sparrowhawk, but how am I called?"
"Hawk, my lord."
Then Aaron bit his tongue. "Practice, nephew," said the Archmage.
"It takes practice.
You've never been anything but a prince, while I have been many things, and last of all, and maybe least, an Archmage. We go south, looking for Emilstone, that blue stuff they carve charms of. I know they value it in Enlad. They make it into charms against rheums, sprains, stiff necks, and, yes, and slips of the tongue." After a moment, Aaron laughed, and as he lifted his head, the boat lifted on a long wave, and he saw the rim of the sun against the edge of the ocean, a flare of sudden gold before them. Sparrowhawk stood with one hand on the mast, for the little boat leapt on the choppy waves, and facing the sunrise of the equinox of spring, he chanted. Aaron did not know the old speech, the tongue of wizards and dragons, but he heard praise and rejoicing in the words, and there was a great striding rhythm in them, like the rise and fall of tides, or the balance of the day and night, each succeeding each for ever. Gulls cried on the wind, and the shores of Thwill Bay slid past to right and left, and they entered on the long waves, full of light, of the inmost sea. From Roke to Hort Town is no great voyage, but they spent 3 nights at sea. The Archmage had been urgent to be gone, but once gone, he was more than patient. The winds turned contrary as soon as they were away from the charmed weather of Roke, but he did not call a mage wind into their sails, as any weather worker could have done. Instead, he spent hours teaching Aaron how to manage the boat in a stiff headwind in the rock-fanged sea of East Issel. The second night out it rained, the rough cold rain of March, but he said no spell to keep it off them. On the next night, as they lay outside the entrance to Hort Harbour in a calm, cold, foggy darkness, Aaron thought about this, and reflected that in this short time he had known him, the Archmage had done no magic at all. He was a peerless sailor, though. Aaron had learned more in 3 days sailing with him than in 10 years of boating and racing on Barilla Bay. And mage and sailor are not so far apart. Both work with the powers of sea and sky, and bend great winds to the use of their hands, bringing near what was remote. Archmage, or hawk, the sea trader, it came to mean much the same thing. He was rather a silent man, though perfectly good-humoured. No clumsiness of Aaron's fretted him. He was companionable. There could be no better shipmate, Aaron thought. But he would go into his own thoughts and be silent for hours on end, and then, when he must speak, there was a harshness in his voice, and he would look right through Aaron. This did not weaken the love the boy felt for him, but maybe it lessened liking somewhat. It was a little awesome. Perhaps Sparrowhawk felt this, for in that foggy night off the shores of Wathort, he began to talk to Aaron, rather haltingly, about himself. "I do not want to go among men again tomorrow," he said. "I have been pretending that I am free, that nothing's wrong in the world, that I'm not the Archmage, not even sorcerer, that I'm Hawk of Tamir, without responsibilities or privileges, owing nothing to anyone." He stopped, and after a while he went on, "Try to choose carefully, Aaron, when the great choices must be made. When I was young, I had to choose between the life of being and the life of doing, and I leapt at the latter like a trout to a fly. But each deed you do, each act, binds you to itself and to its consequences, and makes you act again and yet again. Then very seldom do you come upon a space, a time like this, between act and act, when you may stop and simply be, or wonder who, after all, you are." How could such a man, thought Aaron, be in doubt as to who and what he was? He had believed such doubts were reserved for the young, who had not done anything yet. They rocked in the great, cool darkness. "That's why I like the sea," said Sparrowhawk's voice in that darkness. Aaron understood him, but his own thoughts ran ahead, as they had been doing all these 3 days and nights, to their quest, the aim of their sailing. And since his companion was in a mood to talk, at last he asked, "Do you think we will find what we seek in Hort Town?" Sparrowhawk shook his head, perhaps meaning no, perhaps meaning that he did not know. "Can it be a kind of pestilence, a plague that drifts from land to land, blighting the crops and the flocks and men's spirits?" "A pestilence is a motion of the great balance, of the equilibrium itself. Now this is different. There is the stink of evil in it. We may suffer for it when the balance of things rights itself, but we do not lose hope and forego art and forget the words of the making. Nature is not unnatural. This is not righting of the balance, but an upsetting of it. There is only one creature who can do that." "A man?" Aaron said, tentative. "We men."
"How?"
"By an unmeasured desire for life,
for life. But it isn't wrong to want to live.
No. But when we crave power over life, endless wealth, unassailable safety, immortality, then desire becomes greed. And if knowledge allies itself to that greed, then comes evil. The balance of the world is swayed, and ruin weighs heavy in the scale. Aaron brooded over this a while, and said at last, "Then you think it is a man we seek?" "A man, and a mage." "Aye, I think so. But I had thought, from what my father and teachers taught, that the great arts of wizardry were dependent on the balance, the equilibrium of things, and so could not be used for evil."
"That," said Sparrowhawk somewhat wryly, "is a debatable point. Infinite are the arguments of mages. Every land of Earthsea knows of witches who can cast unclean spells, sorcerers who use their art to win riches. But there is more. The Fire Lord, who sought to undo the darkness and stop the sun at noon, was a great mage. Even Erith Akbi could scarcely defeat him. The enemy of Morred was another such. When he came, whole cities knelt to him, armies fought for him. The spell he wove against Morred was so mighty that even when he was slain, it could not be halted, and the island of Solea was overwhelmed by the sea, and all on it perished. Those were great men in whom great strength and knowledge served the will to evil, and fed upon it. Whether the wizardry that serves a better end may always prove the stronger, we do not know. We hope." There is a certain bleakness in finding hope where one expected certainty. Aaron found himself unwilling to stay on these cold summits. He said after a little while, "I see why you say that only men do evil, I think. Even sharks are innocent. They kill because they must. That is why nothing can resist us. Only one thing in the world can resist an evil-hearted man, and that is another man. In our shame is our glory. Only our spirit, which is capable of evil, is capable of overcoming it."
"But the dragons," said Aaron, "do they not do great evil? Are they innocent?"
"The dragons? Oh, the dragons are avaricious, insatiable, treacherous, without pity, without remorse. But are they evil? Who am I to judge the acts of dragons? They are wiser than men are. It is with them as with dreams, Aaron. We men dream dreams. We work magic. We do good. We do evil. The dragons do not dream. They are dreams. They do not work magic. It is their substance, their being. They do not do. They are."
"In Serelun," said Aaron, "is the skin of Ba'oth, killed by Kaor, prince of Enlad, 300 years ago. No dragons have ever come to Enlad since that day. I saw the skin of Ba'oth. It is as heavy as iron and so large that if it were spread out, it would cover all the marketplace of Serelun," they said. "The teeth are as long as my forearm. Yet they said Ba'oth was a young dragon, not full grown."
"There is a desire in you," said Sparrowhawk, "to see dragons."
"Yes."
"Their blood is cold and venomous. You must not look into their eyes. They are older than mankind." He was silent a while, and then went on, "And though I came to forget or regret all I have ever done, yet I would remember that once I saw the dragons aloft on the wind at sunset above the Western Isles, and I would be content." Both were silent then, and there was no sound but the whispering of the water with the boat, and no light. So at last, there on the deep waters, they slept.
In the bright haze of morning, they came into Hort Harbour, where 100 craft were moored or setting forth. Fishermen's boats, crabbers, trawlers, trading ships, 2 galleys of 20 oars, one great 60-oared galley in bad repair, and some lean, long sailing ships with high triangular sails, designed to catch the upper airs in the hot calms of the South Reach.
"Is that a ship of war?"
Aaron asked as they passed one of the 20-oared galleys, and his companion answered,
"A slaver. A judge, from the chain bolts in her hold. They sell men in the South Reach."
Aaron pondered this a minute, then went to the gearbox and took from it his sword, which he had wrapped up well and stowed away on the morning of their departure. He uncovered it. He stood indecisive, the sheathed sword on his two hands, the belt dangling from it.
"Ah, it's no sea trader's sword," he said. "The scabbard's too fine."
Sparrowhawk, busy at the tiller, shot him a look.
"Wear it if you like."
"I thought it might be wise."
"As swords go, that one is wise," said his companion, his eyes alert on their passage through the crowded bay. "Is it not a sword reluctant to be used?"
Aaron nodded.
"So they say. Yet it has killed. It has killed men."
He looked down at the slender, hand-worn hilt.
"It has, but I have not. It makes me feel a fool. It is too much older than I. I shall take my knife," he ended,
and rewrapping the sword, shoved it down deep in the gearbox. His face was perplexed and angry. Sparrowhawk said nothing, till he said,
"Will you take the oars now, lad? We're heading for the pier, there by the stairs."
Hort Town, one of the seven great ports of the archipelago, rose from its noisy waterfront up the slopes of three steep hills in a jumble of colour. The houses were of clay, plastered in red, orange, yellow, white. The roofs were of purplish-red tile. Pendic trees in flower made masses of dark red along the upper streets. Gaudy striped awnings stretched from roof to roof, shading narrow marketplaces. The quays were bright with sunlight. The streets running back from the waterfront were like dark slots full of shadows and people and noise. When they had tied up the boat, Sparrowhawk stooped over, as if to check the knot, beside Aaron, and he said,
"Aaron, there are people in Wat Hort who know me pretty well, so watch me that you may know me."
When he straightened up, there was no scar on his face. His hair was quite grey. His nose was thick and somewhat snub, and instead of a yew staff, his own height, he carried a wand of ivory, which he tucked away inside his shirt.
"Dost know me?"
he said to Aaron with a broad smile, and he spoke with the accent of Enlad.
"Hast never seen thine uncle before this?"
Aaron had seen wizards at the court of Berlira change their faces when they mimed the deed of Morred, and knew it was only an illusion. He kept his wits about him, and was able to say,
"Oh, aye, Nuncle Orc."
But while the mage bickered with the harbour guardsman over the fee for docking and guarding the boat, Aaron kept looking at him to make sure that he did know him. And as he looked, the transformation troubled him more, not less. It was too complete. This was not the archmage at all. This was no wise guide and leader. The guardsman's fee was high, and Sparrowhawk grumbled as he paid and strode away with Aaron still grumbling.
"A test of my patience," he said. "Pay that swag-bellied thief to guard my boat, but half a spell would do twice the job. Well, this is the price of disguise. And I've forgotten my proper speech, have I not, Nevi?"
They were walking up a crowded, smelly, gaudy street lined with shops, little more than booths, whose owners stood in the doorways among heaps and festoons of wares, loudly proclaiming the beauty and cheapness of their pots, hosiery, hats, spades, pins, purses, kettles, baskets, knives, ropes, bolts, bed linens, and every other kind of hardware and dry goods.
"Is it a fair?"
"Eh?"
said the snub-nosed man, bending his grizzled head.
"Is it a fair, Nuncle?"
"A fair? No, no. They keep it up all year round here. Keep your fish cakes, mistress. I have breakfast."
And Aaron tried to shake off a man with a tray of little brass vases who followed at his heels, whining, "But try, handsome young master, they won't fail ye. Breath as sweet as the roses of Numima, charming the women to ye. Try them, young sea lord, young prince." All at once Sparrowhawk was between Aaron and the peddler, saying, "What charms are these?" "Oh, not charms," the man winced, shrinking away from him. "I sell no charms, sea master, only syrups to sweeten the breath after drink or hazea root. Only syrups, great prince." He cowered right down onto the pavement stones, his tray of vases clinking and clattering, some of them tipping so that a drop of the sticky stuff inside oozed out, pink or purple, over the lip. Sparrowhawk turned away without speaking and went on with Aaron. Soon the crowds thinned, and the shops grew wretchedly poor, little kennels displaying as all their wares a handful of bent nails, a broken pestle, and an old carding comb. This poverty disgusted Aaron less than the rest. In the rich end of the street he had felt choked, suffocated by the pressure of things to be sold, and voices screaming him to buy, buy, and the peddler's abjectness had shocked him. He thought of the cool, bright streets of his northern town. No man in Barila, he thought, would have grovelled to a stranger like that. "Oh, these are foul folk," he said. "This way, Nevi," was all his companion's answer. They turned aside into a passage between high, red, windowless house walls, which ran along the hillside and through the archway garlanded with decaying banners, out again into the sunlight in a steep square, another marketplace, crowded with booths and stalls, and swarming with people and flies. Around the edges of the square, a number of men and women were sitting or lying on their backs, motionless. Their mouths had a curious blackish look, as if they had been bruised, and around their lips flies swarmed and gathered in clusters like bunches of dried currants. "So many," said Sparrowhawk's voice, low and hasty, as if he too had got a shock. But when Aaron looked at him, there was the blunt, bland face of the hearty trader, Hawk, showing no concern. "What's wrong with those people?" "Hazea. It soothes and numbs, letting the body be free of the mind. And the mind roams free, but when it returns to the body it needs more hazea, and the craving grows. And the life is short, for the stuff is poison. First there is trembling, and later paralysis, and then death." Aaron looked at a woman, sitting with her back to a sun-warmed wall. She had raised her hand as if to brush away the flies from her face, but the hand made a jerky, circular motion in the air, as if she had quite forgotten about it, and it was moved only by the repeated surging of a palsy or shaking in the muscles. The gesture was like an incantation, emptied of all intention, a spell without meaning. Hawk was looking at her too, expressionless. "Come on," he said. He led on across the marketplace to an awning-shaded booth. Stripes of sunlight, coloured green, orange, lemon, crimson, azure, fell across the cloths and shawls and woven belts displayed, and danced multitudinous in the tiny mirrors that bedecked the high, feathered headdress of the woman who sold the stuff. She was big, and she chanted in a big voice, "Silks, satins, canvases, furs, felts, woolens, fleece felts of Gaunt, gauzes of Saul, silks of Lorbanary. Hey, you northern men, take off your duffel coats, don't you see the sun's out? How's this to take home to a girl in far Havna? Look at it. Silk of the south, fine as the mayfly's wing." She had flipped open with deft hands a bolt of gauzy silk, pink shot with threads of silver. "Nay, mistress, we're not wed to queens," said Hawk, and a woman's voice rose to a blare. "So what do you dress your women folk in, burlap, sailcloth? Misers like that won't buy a bit of silk for a poor woman freezing in the everlasting northern snow. How's this, then? A Gauntish feast fell, to help you keep her warm on winter nights. She flung out over the counterboard a great cream and brown square, woven of the silky hair of the goats of the northern eastern isles. The pretended trader put out his hand and felt it, and he smiled.
"Aye, you're a Gauntish man," said the blaring voice,
and the headdress nodding sent a thousand coloured dots spinning over the canopy and the cloth.
"Oh, this is Andradian work, see? There's but four warp strings to the finger's width. Gaunt uses six or more. But tell me why you've turned from working magic to selling fripperies. When I was here years since, I saw you pulling flames out of men's ears, and then you made the flames turn into birds and golden bells. Now, that was a finer trade than this one."
"It was no trade at all," the big woman said.
And for a moment, Aaron was aware of her eyes, hard and steady as agates, looking at him and Hawk from out of the glitter and restlessness of her nodding feathers and flashing mirrors.
"Hey, it was pretty, that pulling fire out of ears," said Hawk, in a dour but simple-minded tone. "I thought to show it to my nevy." "Well, now look you," said the woman less harshly, leaning her broad brown arms and heavy bosom on the counter. "We don't do those tricks any more. People don't want them. They've seen through 'em. These mirrors now, I see you remember my mirrors."
And she tossed her head so that the reflected dots of coloured lights whirled dizzily about them.
"Well, you can puzzle a man's mind with the flashing of the mirrors, and with words, and with other tricks I won't tell you, till he thinks he sees what he don't see, what isn't there, like the flames and golden bells, or the suits of clothes I used to deck sailormen in, cloth of gold, with diamonds like apricots, and off they'd swagger like the king of all the isles. But it was tricks, fooleries. You can fool men. They're like chickens charmed by a snake, by a finger held before 'em. Men are like chickens. But then, in the end, they know they've been fooled and fuddled, and they get angry and lose their pleasure in such things. So I turn to this trade, and maybe all the silks aren't silks, nor all the fleeces gauntish, but all the same they'll wear. They're real, and not mere lies and airs, like the suits of cloth of gold."
"Well, well," said Hawk, "then there's none left in all Hort Town to put fire out of ears, or to do any magic like they did." At his last words, the woman frowned. She straightened up and began to fold the fleece fell carefully.
"Those who want lies and visions, chew Hazir," she said. "Talk to them if you like."
She nodded to the unmoving figures around the square.
"But there were sorcerers, they that charmed the winds for seamen and put spells of fortune on their cargoes. Are they all turned to other trades?"
But she, in sudden fury, came blaring in over his words.
"There's a sorcerer, if you want one. A great one, a wizard with a staff and all. See him there? He sailed with Egra himself, making winds and finding fat galleys, so he said. But it was all lies, and Captain Egra gave him his just reward at last. He cut his right hand off, and there he sits now. See him? With his mouth full of Hazir, and his belly full of air. Air and lies, air and lies. That's all there is to your magic, sea captain goat."
"Well, well, mistress," said Hawk, with obdurate mildness. "I was only asking." She turned her broad back with a great dazzle of whirling mirror dots, and he ambled off, Aaron beside him. His amble was purposeful. It brought them near the man she had pointed out. He sat propped against a wall, staring at nothing. The dark, bearded face had been very handsome once. The wrinkled wrist stump lay on the pavement stones in the hot, bright sunlight. Shameful. There was some commotion among the booths behind them, but Aaron found it hard to look away from the man. A loathing fascination held him.
"Was he really a wizard?"
he asked, very low.
"He may be the one called Hare, who was weather worker for the pirate Egre. Oh, they were famous thieves."
"Yes, stand clear, Aaron."
A man running full tilt out from among the booths nearly slammed into them both. Another came trotting by, struggling under the weight of a great folding tray loaded with cords and braids and laces. A booth collapsed with a crash. Awnings were being pushed over or taken down hurriedly. Knots of people shoved and wrestled through the marketplace. Voices rose in shouts and screams. Above them all rang the blaring yell of a woman with a headdress of mirrors. Aaron glimpsed her wielding some kind of pole or stick against a bunch of men, fending them off with great sweeps like a swordsman at bay. Whether it was a quarrel that had spread and become a riot, or an attack by a gang of thieves, or a fight between two rival lots of peddlers, there was no telling. People rushed by with armfuls of goods that could be loot, or their own property saved from looting. There were knife fights, fist fights, and brawls all over the square. "That way," said Aaron, pointing to a side street that led out of the square near them, and started for it, for it was clear that they had better get out at once. But his companion caught his arm. Aaron looked back, and saw that the man Hare was struggling to his feet. When he got himself erect, he stood swaying a moment, and then without a look around him, he set off around the edge of the square, trailing his single hand along the house walls, as if to guide him or support himself.
"Keep him in sight," Sparrowhawk said,
and they set off, following. No one molested them, or the man they followed, and in a minute they were out of the market square, going downhill in the silence of a narrow, twisting street. Overhead, the attics of the houses almost met across the street, cutting out light. Underfoot, the stones were slippery with water and refuse. Hare went along at a good pace, though he kept trailing his hand along the walls like a blind man. They had to keep pretty close behind him, lest they lose him at a cross street. The excitement of the chase came into Aaron suddenly. His senses were all alert, as they were during a stag hunt in the forests of Enlad. He saw vividly each face they passed, and breathed in the sweet stink of the city, a smell of garbage, incense, carrion and flowers. As they threaded their way across a broad, crowded street, he heard a drum beat, and caught a glimpse of a line of naked men and women, chained each to the next by wrist and waist, matted hair hanging over their faces. One glimpse, and they were gone, as he dodged after Hare down a flight of steps and out into a narrow square, empty but for a few women gossiping at a fountain. There, Sparrowhawk caught up with Hare and set a hand on his shoulder, at which Hare cringed as if scalded, wincing away, and backed into the shelter of a massive doorway. There he stood, shivering, and stared at them with the unseeing eyes of the hunted.
"Are you called Hare?"
asked Sparrowhawk, and he spoke in his own voice, which was harsh in quality but gentle in intonation. The man said nothing, seeming not to heed and not to hear.
"I want something of you," Sparrowhawk said.
Again no response.
"I'll pay for it."
A slow reaction.
"Ivory or gold?"
"Gold."
"How much?"
"The wizard knows the spell's worth." Hara's face flinched and changed, coming alive for an instant, so quickly that it seemed to flicker, then clouding again into blankness.
"That's all gone," he said.
"All gone."
A coughing fit bent him over. He spat black. When he straightened up, he stood passive, shivering, seeming to have forgotten what they were talking about. Again Aaron watched him in fascination. The angle in which he stood was formed by two giant figures flanking a doorway, statues whose necks were bowed under the weight of a pediment and whose knot-muscled bodies emerged only partially from the wall, as if they had tried to struggle out of stone into life and had failed part way. The door they guarded was rotten on its hinges. The house, once a palace, was derelict. The gloomy, bulging faces of the giants were chipped and lichen-grown. Between these ponderous figures, the man called Hare stood slack and fragile, his eyes as dark as the windows of the empty house. He lifted up his maimed arm between himself and Sparrowhawk and whined,
"Spare a little for a poor cripple, master."
The mage scowled as if in pain or shame. Aaron felt he had seen his true face for a moment under the disguise. He put his hand again on Hara's shoulder and said a few words, softly, in the wizardly tongue that Aaron did not understand. But Hare understood. He clutched at Sparrowhawk with his one hand and stammered,
You can still speak. Speak. Come with me. Come.
The mage glanced at Aaron, then nodded. They went down by steep streets into one of the valleys between Hort Town's three hills. The ways became narrower, darker, quieter as they descended. The sky was a pale strip between the overhanging eaves, and the house walls to either side were dank. At the bottom of the gorge, a stream rang, stinking like an open sewer. Between arched bridges, houses crowded along its banks, and into the dark doorway of one of these houses, Hari turned aside, vanishing like a candle blown out. They followed him. The unlit stairs creaked and swayed beneath their feet. At the head of the stairs, Hare pushed open a door, and they could see where they were, an empty room with a straw-stuffed mattress in one corner, and one unglazed, shuttered window that let in a little dusty light. Hare turned to face Sparrowhawk and caught at his arm again. His lips worked. He said at last, stammering,
"Dragon, dragon."
Sparrowhawk returned his look steadily, saying nothing.
"I cannot speak,"
Hare said, and he let go his hold on Sparrowhawk's arm and crouched down on the empty floor, weeping. The mage knelt by him and spoke to him softly in the old speech. Aaron stood by the shut door, his hand on his knife hilt. The grey light and the dusty room, the two kneeling figures, the soft, strange sound of the mage's voice speaking the language of the dragons, all came together as does a dream, having no relation to what happens outside, or to time passing. Slowly, Hari stood up. He dusted his knees with his single hand, and hid the maimed arm behind his back. He looked around him, looked at Aaron. He was seeing what he looked at now. He turned away presently and sat down on his mattress. Aaron remained standing, on guard, but with the simplicity of one whose childhood was totally unfurnished, Sparrowhawk sat down cross-legged on the bare floor. "Tell me how you lost your craft, and the language of your craft," he said. Hare did not answer for a while. He began to beat his mutilated arm against his thigh in a restless, jerky way. And at last he said, forcing the words out in bursts,
"They cut off my hand. I can't weave the spells. They cut off my hand. The blood ran out, ran dry."
"But that was after you'd lost your power, Hare, or else they could not have done it."
"Power?"
"Power over the winds and the waves and men. You called them by their names, and they obeyed you."
"Yes, I remember being alive,"
said the man in a soft, hoarse voice.
"And I knew the words and the names."
"Are you dead now?"
"No, alive, alive. Only once I was a dragon. I'm not dead. I sleep sometimes. Sleep comes very close to death, everyone knows that. The dead walk in dreams, everyone knows that. They come to you alive and they say things. They walk out of death into dreams. Oh, there's a way. And if you go on far enough, there's a way back, all the way, all the way. You can find it if you know where to look, and if you're willing to pay the price."
"What price is that?" Sparrowhawk's voice floated on the dim air like a shadow of a falling leaf.
"Life. What else? What can you buy life with but life?"
Hare rocked back and forth on his pallet, a cunning, uncanny brightness in his eyes.
"You see," he said, "they can cut off my hand. They can cut off my head. It doesn't matter. I can find the way back. I know where to look. Only men of power can go there."
"Wizards, you mean?"
"Yes."
Hare hesitated, seeming to attempt the word several times. He could not say it.
"Men of power,"
he repeated.
And they must give it up. Pay."
Then he fell sullen, as if the word pay had at last roused associations, and he had realized that he was giving information away instead of selling it. Nothing more could be got out of him. Not even the hints and stammers about a way back, which Sparrowhawk seemed to find meaningful. And soon enough, the mage stood up.
"Well, half answers beat no answer," he said.
and the same with payment. And deft as a conjurer, he flipped a gold piece onto the pallet in front of Hare. Hare picked it up. He looked at it, and Sparrowhawk, and Aaron, with jerky movements of his head.
"Wait!"
he stammered. As soon as the situation changed, he lost his grip of it, and now groped miserably after what he wanted to say.
"Tonight,"
he said at last.
"Wait, tonight. I have Hazir."
"I don't need it."
To show you the way. Tonight, I'll take you. I'll show you. You can get there because you're...
He groped for the word until Sparrowhawk said, "I am a wizard."
"Yes, so we can get there, to the way. When I dream, in the dream, see, I'll take you. You'll go with me to the way."
Sparrowhawk stood, solid and pondering, in the middle of the dim room. "Maybe," he said at last, "if we come, we'll be here by dark." Then he turned to Aaron, who opened the door at once, eager to be gone. The dank, overshadowed street seemed bright as a garden after Hari's room. They struck out for the upper city by the shortest way, a steep stairway of stone between ivy-grown house walls. Aaron breathed in and out like a sea lion.
"Oh, are you going back there?"
"Well, I will, if I can't get the same information from a less risky source. He's likely to set an ambush for us."
"But aren't you defended against thieves and so on?"
"Defended?" said Sparrowhawk. "What do you mean? Do you think I go wrapped up in spells like an old woman afraid of rheumatism? I haven't the time for it. I haved my face to hide our quest, that's all. We can look out for each other. But the fact is, we're not going to be able to keep out of danger on this journey."
"Of course not,"
Aaron said stiffly, angry, angered in his pride.
"I did not seek to do so."
"That's just as well," the mage said, inflexible, and yet with a kind of good humour that appeased Aaron's temper. Indeed, he was startled by his own anger. He had never thought to speak thus to the Archmage. But then, this was and was not the Archmage, this hawk with the snub nose and square, ill-shaven cheeks, whose voice was sometimes one man's voice and sometimes another's. A stranger, unreliable.
"Does it make sense, what he told you?"
Aaron asked, for he did not look forward to going back to that dim room above the stinking river.
"All that fibble-fabble about being alive and dead and coming back with his head cut off?"
"I don't know if it makes sense. I wanted to talk with a wizard who had lost his power. He says that he hasn't lost it, but given it, traded it."
"For what?"
"Life for life," he said. "Power for power." "No, I don't understand him, but he is worth listening to." Sparrowhawk's steady reasonableness shamed Aaron further. He felt himself petulant and nervous, like a child. Hare had fascinated him, but now that fascination was broken, he felt a sick disgust, as if he had eaten something vile. He resolved not to speak again until he had controlled his temper. Next moment, he missed his step on the worn, slick stairs, slipped, recovered himself, scraping his hands on the stones.
"Oh, curse this filthy town!"
he broke out in rage. And the mage replied dryly, "No need to, I think." There was indeed something very wrong about Hort Town, wrong in the very air, so that one might think seriously that it lay under a curse. And yet this was not a presence of any quality, but rather an absence, a weakening of all qualities, like a sickness that soon infected the spirit of any visitor. Even the warmth of the afternoon sun was sickly, too heavy a heat for March. The squares and streets bustled with activity and business, but there was neither order nor prosperity. Goods were poor, prices high, and the markets were unsafe for vendors and buyers alike, being full of thieves and roaming gangs. Not many women were on the streets, and then mostly in groups. It was a city without law or governance. Talking with people,
Aaron and Sparrowhawk soon learned that there was in fact no council or mayor or lord left in Hort Town. Some of those who had used to rule the city had died, and some had resigned, and some had been assassinated. Various chiefs lorded it over various quarters of the city. The harbour guardsmen ran the port and lined their pockets, and so on. There was no centre left of the city. The people, for all their restless activity, seemed purposeless. Craftsmen seemed to lack the will to work well. Even the robbers robbed because it was all they knew how to do. All the brawl and brightness of a great port city was there on the surface, but all about the edges of it sat the Hazir eaters, motionless. And under the surface, things did not seem entirely real, not even the faces, the sounds, the smells. They would fade from time to time during that long, warm afternoon, while Sparrowhawk and Aaron walked the streets and talked with this person and that. They would fade quite away, the striped awnings, the dirty cobbles, the coloured walls, and all vividness of being would be gone, leaving the city a dream city, empty and dreary in the hazy sunlight. Only at the top of the town, where they went to rest a while in the late afternoon, did this sickly mood of daydream break for a while. "This is not a town for luck," Sparrowhawk had said some hours ago. And now, after hours of aimless wandering and fruitless conversations with strangers, he looked tired and grim. His disguise was wearing a little thin. A certain hardness and darkness could be seen through the bluff sea-trader's face. Aaron had never been able to shake off the morning's irritability. They sat down on the coarse turf of the hilltop under the eaves of a grove of pendic trees, dark-leaved and budded thickly with red buds, some open. From there, they saw nothing of the city but its tile roofs, multitudinously scaling downward to the sea. The bay opened its arms wide, slate-blue beneath the spring haze, reaching onto the edge of air. No lines were drawn, no boundaries. They sat gazing at that immense blue space. Aaron's mind cleared, opening out to meet and celebrate the world. When they went to drink from a little stream nearby, running clear over brown rocks from its spring in some princely garden on the hill behind them, he drank deep and doused his head right under the cold water. Then he got up and declaimed the lines from the Deed of Mored. "Praised are the fountains of Shelieth, the silver harp of the waters, but blessed in my name for ever this stream that staunched my thirst." Sparrowhawk laughed at him, and he also laughed. He shook his head like a dog, and the bright spray flew out fine in the last gold sunlight. They had to leave the grove and go down into the streets again, and when they had made their supper at a stall that sold greasy fish cakes, night was getting heavy in the air. Darkness came fast in the narrow streets. "We better go, lad," said Sparrowhawk. And Aaron said, "To the boat?" But knew it was not to be the boat, but to the house above the river, and the empty, dusty, terrible room. Hare was waiting for them in the doorway. He lighted an oil lamp to show them up the black stairs. Its tiny flame trembled continually as he held it, throwing vast, quick shadows up the walls. He had got another sack of straw for his visitors to sit on, but Aaron took his place on the bare floor by the door. The door opened outward, and to guard it, he should have sat himself down outside it. But that pitch-black hall was more than he could stand, and he wanted to keep an eye on Hare. Sparrowhawk's attention, and perhaps his powers, were going to be turned on what Hare had to tell him or show him. It was up to Aaron to keep alert for trickery. Hare held himself straighter and trembled less. He had cleaned his mouth and teeth. He spoke sanely enough at first, though with excitement. His eyes in the lamplight were so dark that they seemed, like the eyes of animals, to show no whites. He disputed earnestly with Sparrowhawk, urging him to eat Hazir. "I want to take you. Take you with me. We've got to go the same way. Before long, I'll be going whether you're ready or not. You must have the Hazir to follow me. I think I can follow you.
Not where I'm going. This isn't spell-casting.
He seemed unable to say the words wizard or wizardry.
I know you can get to the place, you know, the wall, but it isn't there. It's a different way.
If you go, I can follow. Hare shook his head. His handsome, ruined face was flushed. He glanced over at Aaron often, including him, though he spoke only to Sparrowhawk.
Look, there are two kinds of man, aren't there? Our kind and the rest. The dragons and the others. People without power are only half alive. They don't count. They don't know what they dream. They're afraid of the dark. But the others, the lords of men, aren't afraid to go into the dark. We have strength.
So long as we know the names of things.
But names don't matter there. That's the point. That's the point. It isn't what you do, what you know that you need. Spells are no good. You have to forget all that, to let it go. That's where eating Hazir helps. You forget the names. You let the forms of things go. You go straight to the reality.
I'm going to be going pretty soon now. If you want to find out where, you ought to do as I say. I say as he does. You must be a lord of men to be a lord of life. You have to find the secret. I could tell you its name.
But what's a name? A name isn't real. The real forever. Dragons can't go there. Dragons die. They all die.
I took so much tonight, you'll never catch me. Not a patch on me. Where I get lost, you can lead me.
Remember what the secret is. Remember. No death. No death. No.
No sweaty bed and rotting coffin. No more. Never. The blood dries up like the dry river and it's gone. No fear. No death. The names are gone and the words and the fear gone. Show me where I can get lost. Show me, Lord. So he went on, in a choked rapture of words that was like the chanting of a spell, and yet made no spell, no whole, no sense. Aaron listened. Listened, striving to understand. If only he could understand. Sparrowhawk should do as he said, and take the drug, this once, so that he could find out what Hare was talking about. The mystery that he would not or could not speak. Why else were they here? But then, Aaron looked from Hare's ecstatic face to the other profile. Perhaps the mage understood already. Hard as rock, that profile. Where was the snub nose, the bland look? Hawk the sea trader was gone, forgotten. It was the mage, the arch-mage, who sat there. Hare's voice was now a crooning mumble, and he rocked his body as he sat cross-legged. His face had grown haggard, and his mouth slack. Facing him in the tiny, steady light of the oil lamp set on the floor between them, the other never spoke, but he had reached out and taken Hare's hand, holding him. Aaron had not seen him reach out. There were gaps in the order of events, gaps of non-existence. Drowsiness, it must be. Surely some hours had passed. It might be near midnight. If he slept, would he too be able to follow Hare into his dream and come to the place, the secret way? Perhaps he could. It seemed quite possible now. But he was to guard the door. He and Sparrowhawk had scarcely spoken of it, but both were aware that in having them come back at night, Hare might have planned some ambush. He had been a pirate. He knew robbers. They had said nothing, but Aaron knew that he was to stand guard, for while the mage made this strange journey of the spirit, he would be defenseless. But like a fool, he had left his sword on board the boat, and how much good would his knife be if that door swung suddenly open behind him? But that would not happen. He could listen and hear. Hare was not speaking any more. Both men were utterly silent. The whole house was silent. Nobody could come up those swaying stairs without some noise. He could speak if he heard a noise, shout aloud, and the trance would break, and Sparrowhawk would turn and defend himself, and Aaron with all the vengeful lightning of a wizard's rage. When Aaron had sat down at the door, Sparrowhawk had looked at him, only a glance, approval, approval and trust. He was the guard. There was no danger if he kept on guard. But it was hard, hard to keep watching those two faces, the little pearl of lamp flame between them on the floor, both silent now, both still, their eyes open, but not seeing the light or the dusty room, not seeing the world, but some other world of dream or death. To watch them and not try to follow them. There, in the vast, dry darkness, there stood one beckoning. "Come," he said, the tall Lord of Shadows. In his hand he held a tiny flame no larger than a pearl, held it out to Aaron, offering life. Slowly, Aaron took one step towards him, following.